commencing countdown.
3, 2, 1.
This is the Contracting Experience. Connecting government contracting professionals to the world around them through conversations with acquisition influencers, insights into evolving hot topics, and sharing lessons learned from the field.
Welcome, podcast listeners. On this episode of The Contracting Experience, we're exploring a critical area of acquisition that doesn't always get the attention it deserves: labor law compliance and government contracting. So joining us today, we have the expert in this matter, Kyle Roberts, who is the Chief of Air Force Labor Advisors. His recent webinars on the top 12 biggest mistakes related to federal labor laws and Air Force contracting has been making the rounds, and we're excited to dig in today, maybe a slightly different format, maybe a slightly different emphasis with maybe bring in our industry partners as well as our other services. So Kyle, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, sir. It's great to be here virtually and looking forward to this.
All right. Excellent, Kyle. So before we get into these big mistakes, let's start off with the basics. So can you tell us what the Air Force Labor Advisors do? And you probably have components in the other services. And what does your mission look like day to day?
Fantastic. Thank you, sir. Well, on a day-to-day basis, we aim at and provide support to the field contracting workforce. That is, the contracting professionals across the Air Force and Space Force that are out there getting it done. If you look right at the beginning of FAR Part 22, the agency of labor advisor is defined, but I'll put it in more practical terms. We are here to help you with the practical effects and application of federal labor laws to government contracts. And that is both in terms of pre-award activities as well as post-award slash administration and compliance activities. So, for instance, contracting officer has a question about whether or not a certain labor law applies. And if it does, what is it going to do to his contract? We're here to help that contract officer and guide them through that process. Our team is a small one. I am lucky and blessed to work with three other individuals, Gary Leckman, Will Fugate, and Matt Passage. Together, the four of us try to take care of the entire Air Force and Space Force contracting workforce and provide fraternal support to our other DoD components and other government partners. We are typically, let me rephrase that. We are by and large ex-contracting officers. We bring about 100 years of contracting experience to the table, but with a notable exception of Gary Leckman, who brings some Department of Labor experience to us, a little bit of a different perspective and a little bit of a different spin on things, but is very, very helpful when it comes time to looking at compliance and execution of these laws inside the contracts. So secondary to those, we also monitor and report on labor disputes. We don't mediate them. That's the job of another federal agency. We will aid contracting officers when those unfortunate events arise. We also, from time to time, get involved a little bit in policy implementation. I hesitate to say policy development because we don't really have any independent ideas that we can manifest into the FAR or some kind of policy letter, if you will. But we do help determine how we're going to implement, certain executive orders and provide some practical guidance on, for instance, federal minimum wage executive orders. How will those be implemented at the ground level? How should the contracting agency deal with that kind of policy implementation? So in very broad strokes, that's what we do. But number one, we're here to help.
All right. Excellent, Kyle. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a broad portfolio, right? Policy implementation, consultation training, even real-time mission support. So valuable resource you and your team provide there. Absolutely. So, well, let's walk through some of these labor-related mistakes, or maybe we'll call them oversights, right, that you've seen in the
right
field. So, yeah, maybe you can share what maybe these oversights look like in practice and why it happens and how contracting professionals can maybe avoid some of these mistakes or oversights. So one of them that you mentioned in the webinar was assuming contracts are exempt from labor laws. This one seems like a foundational misunderstanding. What leads people to assume the Service Contract Act or the Davis-Bacon Act doesn't apply to them?
Well, sir, a lot of the times I think it just stems from a basic misunderstanding or a misreading of the requirement. Oftentimes, it's patently obvious what we're buying when we, you know, receive a requirements package. For instance, hey, we need to procure grass cutting services. Well, it's right there in the title of the requirement. It's pretty easy. Or, hey, go dig a hole and put a new building on top of that hole. Pretty obvious. But things get a little bit more muddled and a little bit more murky, if you will, when requirements are met. Or they're not clearly expressed. And then there's also some misconceptions out there. For instance, I don't say I battle against it, but there is no exemption, for instance, just because we're buying commercial services. For instance, the labor laws by and large don't really care about the method of procurement, whether you're using FAR Part 12 or 14 or 15 or simplified acquisition procedures, just doesn't matter. So there's just a little bit of misunderstanding, but I think a lot of it can also be laid at maybe sometimes we don't express our requirements clearly. That's probably the most common reason right there.
Okay. No, yeah, that's great. Thanks for that clarification there. And so then kind of another mistake you highlight is failing to incorporate the correct wage determination. So once we know a labor law applies, we've confirmed what we're buying and the applicability, it's kind of crucial to apply the correct wage determination, right? Where did things go wrong there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we can always blame friction and fog. We know that comes with the territory here. A lot of the times we forget that wage determinations change. Sometimes they change very often. For instance, I know of one Davis-Bacon wage determination that used to get updated every 2 weeks. So that's a new revision every 2 weeks that a contracting officer would have to be aware of and be able to plug into their RFPs. A lot of another common thing or a common, I don't want to say mistake, but an overlooked aspect is that typically we are vulnerable to having to update wage determinations up until the time of award, and even sometimes even after award, but before performance begins. So how does that really manifest itself? Well, unfortunately, when we have very large requirements or let me rephrase that, very complex requirements that may require a lengthy evaluation period. And for instance, I've sat on source selection teams that have been in evaluations for a year or more. Easy for us to forget as an evaluation team that wage determinations are changing while we're still in evaluations. We're still vulnerable to having to update. And completely understandable that no contracting officer wants to sort of restart the clock on evaluations just by amending the RFP in the midst of that process. So those are probably the two biggest reasons. It's just forgetting that they evolve, and secondarily, our evaluations are so long and we don't want to reset the clock. But it happens. So just be aware of those. We're always vulnerable generally up until performance begins. Within certain reasons, if you have questions on applicability or timeliness and effectiveness of a wage determination, remember, you can always reach out to your regional labor advisor and they'll help you find the right answer. Over.
All right. No, excellent. Excellent, Kyle. Yeah. And again, absolutely. We just have to, stay abreast of all of those current changes. Again, it might not be great news to hear, hey, there's a new wage determination. Nobody likes the rework, but sometimes absolutely critical. And there's a lot more rework down the line if it gets overlooked. So, yeah, good point there. So another common oversight you identify is not enforcing the Davis-Bacon Act as the contracting officer. So you mentioned in the webinar that the enforcement, it's not just the Department of Labor's job. It's on the CO. Can you explain maybe this misconception?
You bet. I mean, enforcing labor laws. I mean, it just, from a common sense perspective, that ought to belong to the Department of Labor, right? I mean, that's sort of why they exist. But however, believe it or not, way back in 1950, just before the beginning of the Korean War, President Truman tasked contracting agencies with being primary enforcers of the Davis-Bacon Act. This was a recognition that the Department of Labor did not have adequate resources to actually, go out and be present on every job site. And and check every payroll that comes across from a contractor. So from a more, I guess, a more common sense and ownership perspective, at the end of the day, this is our requirement after all. And we sort of want to take ownership of that, and compliance and administration of the labor laws helps ensure successful persecution and completion of the work at the end of the day. I mean, after all, if the workers are getting paid what they're supposed to be paid, they should be happy, they should perform. We're not going to have to worry about people quitting to take other jobs because they're being mistreated, or even worse, going on strike because they haven't been paid properly, or alternately being mistreated or perceived to be mistreated by their employer. So it all stems from back in the 1950s. Service Contract Act is, of course, radically different, but we do have some limited authority under the Service Contract Act. But the Davis-Bacon one is probably the biggest one. So I always tell contracting officers, the time to begin enforcement is when you award the contract. Don't wait until the end of the contract to review those stacks of payrolls that come from the contractor. Start early. Set the tone. That ounce of prevention will be more than worth a pound of cure if you have to go back and correct an underpayment issue, for instance, 6 months into performance. So that's really what it flows from. And to be honest, enforcement can be a lot of tedious work. I know contracting officers are busy. I know Davis-Bacon enforcement was probably one of my least favorite things to do when I was a contracting officer, but it's necessary and it's important. I mean, ultimately, it affects the people that are executing our requirements. Over.
All right. Great, Kyle. And again, they can always reach out to your team if they have any questions or concerns during that process. So
absolutely.
Yeah, great stuff. All right. So here's another one. Sort of related, but another oversight is ignoring predecessor collective bargaining agreements, or CBAs. So a lot of folks may not realize that CBA rates follow a contract. So what should we know about honoring those agreements?
Great question. And this is another one of those, I keep using this term, common sense kind of issues. It just doesn't seem right that a successor contractor should be held to a collective bargaining agreement that they had no voice in agreeing or negotiating or agreeing to. And the heck, they're not even signatory to it, right? But this comes from Section 4C of the Service Contract Act. And this is where really Congress expressed its intent with the Service Contract Act to set certain wage floors and protect wages and benefits, and more particularly to protect them in between contract transitions. It all dates from an incident. I won't name the location, but it is close to me when contracts would transition over a weekend. Employees working under a collective bargaining agreement might have been paid $10 an hour by the predecessor, and the one the successor took over on Monday, their pay was cut to $5 an hour. Naturally, you can expect that would tend to disrupt work. Nobody likes being paid less for doing the same work. Long story short, Congress eventually acted and said, this is what we meant. So this will get Section 4C that requires a predecessor collective bargaining agreement to essentially follow into a successor contract. What that means in practical terms is that a successor contractor must pay at least the minimum wages and benefits that the predecessor was paying under their collective bargaining agreement. Doesn't mean they have to become signatory to the CBA. Doesn't mean that they have to, recognize a union, although for all intents and purposes, they almost always do. But it does provide for stability of wages and fringe benefits, which, again, provides a tangible government benefit to the government in that our requirement is less likely to be disturbed by non-performance if the workforce doesn't have to fear for the safety of their wages and benefits. So again, you're putting a successor in an unenviable position where they're going to have to honor portions of an agreement that was not negotiated by them, but it does provide a benefit to the government and to the taxpayer at large by reducing that disruption during what may already be a difficult transition period. I know some contract transitions are easy, some are hard, but this takes another one of those variables out of the equation and increases the likelihood that transition will be successful and thus our requirements will be met.
Over. All right. Yeah, that's a interesting concept there. And I can see how maybe that would be, as you mentioned, one of the more common oversights there. Again, not something we think about, but again, honoring those employees that have been working on the contract before. So, yeah, totally makes sense, as you say, but I can kind of see how that one might get overlooked. Interesting stuff. So Moon, how about this one you mentioned? Failing to maintain government neutrality during labor disputes. Now, this one sounds like a leadership and legal landmine. So what does neutrality really mean, and what does it look like when it's violated?
Fantastic. Well, neutrality means that we are Switzerland in the midst of a labor dispute between a contractor and their employees. Typically, they're unionized employees. Let alone fact, a union doesn't have to be in place for employees to engage in organized activity. Even though there's no union agreement, employees can still go on strike because there are certain rights that the National Labor Relations Act confers upon employees, and one of those is that right to strike. And that is also where the concept of neutrality and avoiding being entangled in that strike comes from. So as long as we're neutral and we are not taking a side in the dispute, we cannot be entangled in a dispute. And what that means in practical terms is we cannot be struck. In other words, the striking parties cannot affect us as a neutral. We have the right to conduct our business unimpeded by that strike. What that may look like at the base level is the concept of limiting strike activity to one gate, for instance. If we have an installation with multiple gates, we have the right as a neutral party to tell the striking parties, hey, confine your activity, which is protected activity and protected by the National Labor Relations Act. You won't see that in the FAR, but you can confine your striking activity to gate one over there, and we're going to let gates 2, 3, and 4 continue unimpeded. In a very basic forms, that means that deliveries to the installation will continue unimpeded by the strike. You may guess that a trucker delivering a load of goods may be a little reluctant to confront a picket line, given that a large portion of American truckers are associated with unions. What that really means, though, is that trucker then doesn't have to deal with the picket line and honoring his union requirements. Rather, he can continue unimpeded through one of the so-called neutral gates. In basic terms, that means the shelves at the commissary stay stocked, and AFES continues getting goods. Gas keeps getting delivered to the base gas stations, even if there's a strike going on at another installation or another portion of the installation. When neutrality is not upheld, that then opens the gate for a striking party to view us as an ally of the other party in the dispute and then take actions and sanctions against us. Again, what that would mean at the base level is instead of being able to confine picketing to one portion of the installation, we would be open to picketing at all portions of the installation, all gates. That would then mean those deliveries of fuel to the gas station and the delivery of food and other materials to the commissary and AFES, or just even basic deliveries of supplies that we've ordered, would not necessarily go unimpeded or uninterrupted. So again, that neutrality allows us to continue doing our business. At a larger and more macro level, even when we're not dealing with an installation level strike, that neutrality allows us to remain sort of aloof to a strike. So let's say there's a strike at a contractor's facility. We have the right as a neutral to still access that facility and inspect any work that's going on there. So say let's say we're having an aircraft built someplace and the strike goes on, we would still be able to send our DCMA people or even our Air Force quality assurance folks into that factory, have a look at the work that's being done, and continue, executing contract performance to the degree the contractor could. So that neutrality, maintaining that neutrality allows us to really, so I don't want to say soar above the dispute, but remain uninvolved and able to act in our own selfish motives. And I don't mean selfish in a pejorative sense, but in a positive sense, in order to look out for our interests and the Air Force's interests, which is job number one here. Over.
All right. No, yeah, great examples there, Kyle. And again, something a lot of our listeners might not be familiar with, but yeah, great examples on the neutrality and protecting the government interests there when a labor dispute is involved. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. So let's shift gears a little bit to maybe some mistakes now involving how we define and classify our contract types and services. So getting into the classification realm. So one of your big mistakes you highlight or oversights that you've seen is when folks misclassify contracts as commercial items to avoid the Service Contract Act or the Davis-Bacon Act. Now, that sounds very tempting, but I'm guessing that's a shortcut that doesn't hold up. So what should people know before checking that box?
You bet. And it is absolutely tempting. And we've all been there as contracting officers, under the gun, brand new requirement slides across your desk, and you've got deadlines to meet. So you're taking whatever shortcuts you can in order to stay between the lines. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, there is no outright commercial exemption for application of the Davis-Bacon and Service Contract Act. I alluded to it a little bit earlier. These two laws don't really care about how we procure things. They just care about what we're procuring. The use of FAR Part 12 does allow a lot greater flexibility to the contracting officer, compressed timelines, use of simplified acquisition procedures, but it doesn't allow us to avoid ensuring that the wage and benefit protections that Congress intended to provide to people working on government contracts can be eliminated. So there's just no outright exemption there. And I understand why people might develop that misconception, because FAR Part 12 is such a wonderful tool. It does allow you to really not necessarily think outside the box, but to take in liberties is perhaps has some negative connotations, but take some liberties and tailor situations as you may, and really get things done quicker and in a more efficient manner. But having said all that, SCA or Davis-Bacon, either one, don't necessarily cause any additional complications. It's just a matter of, hey, if this is a service requirement, you could still use FAR Part 12. You can still use simplified acquisition procedures. Just remember to attach the appropriate wage termination and include the clauses. And the rest of the work is largely going to fall on the contractor to do with certain exceptions. So it's just an unfortunate misconception that's out there. There are a lot of other examples of misconceptions that SCA doesn't apply to certain requirements or not, but I'll foot stomp this again at the end. When in doubt, remember, your regional labor advisor is only a phone call, email, or Teams call away. We can help you through that. Over.
All right. No, great, Kyle. Yep, absolutely. Again, big takeaway there. There is not an exemption for the Service Contract Act or Davis-Bacon Act, even though you might be acquiring commercial services. So great point there. All right. So how about this one? This one might be a sleeper issue, but you identify when folks don't update wage determinations when the statement of work changes. What causes people to miss this one?
I think this is a lot of just a presumption that, once the wage determination goes in, that there's no further work to do. But we do have to recognize, and this is somewhat addressed by CICA and the whole changes clause in FAR Part 43. But when we're making major changes to the requirement, that may cause us to need to go back and revisit our wage determinations, just like it may have to cause us to look at our CICA compliance, as well as whether we're really doing an in-scope change. So they're not all necessarily tied together, but they do tend to go together. For instance, let's say I have a contract for grass cutting services, as I alluded to earlier, but now I'm going to change that requirement to also include aircraft maintenance with it. Apart from the CICA and the consideration of, is this change really within the scope of the requirement, we'd also have to think, maybe the employer would approach this work a little bit differently if they knew that aircraft maintenance was going to be involved in it at the beginning. So this is not necessarily a huge deal in the services world, since SCA wage determinations tend to be fairly broad and general in nature. I mean, you generally get 250 different classifications on it, but it has more pronounced effects in the Davis-Bacon world, where different types of wage determinations feature different, not only different classifications, but even different rates of pay and fringe benefits for the same classification. Example, I have a requirement to construct a building. I will probably enclose a building wage determination with that RFP and the resultant contract. Later on, as I'm in the midst of executing that contract, I decide I would like to also now build a road to that building and connect it to another road network a fairly short distance away. In that case, I've definitely made I hate to use the term scope, but I've changed the scope of the contract to the point that an offeror might have approached it a different way, and there will definitely be some impacts to the contractor upon me bringing that new work to the requirement. In this case, I would probably need to modify the contract to also include a highway wage determination in addition to the original building wage determination I have there, because that new road work goes along with the heavier highway wage determination. So a couple of examples there. Again, remember your area or your regional labor advisor is there to help you. Over.
All right. And again, great examples once again there, Kyle. And yeah, again, just whenever that statement of work changes, that those wage determinations, you know, should be at the forefront of your mind. You know, what all changes with that statement of work change? Wage determination should be one of those things that jumps to the top of the mind there. So great job there. All right. So how about this one? Maybe straightforward, but another oversight you mentioned is not applying the labor laws at the correct thresholds. So let's talk numbers. When do these labor laws kick in, and why do folks sometimes miscalculate these?
Got it. This is a constant source of pain, unfortunately. So Davis-Bacon has a $2,000 threshold, and the Service Contract Act has a $2,500 threshold, and those are pretty small in the grand scheme of things. Don't get me wrong, $2,000 is $2,000, but in the grand scheme of government contracts and what you can get for that $2,000, it's not very much. Nevertheless, those numbers are hard-coded into the statute and in the law. They are not inflation adjustable, and they will require a literal act of Congress to be changed. That also causes a little bit of unrest in dealing with the GPC. It's so tempting to want to do as much as we can with the GPC, but the fact is, it's very hard to staple a wage determination to a credit card order or you know, swipe the wage determination with a credit card. So it is what it is. What I see the most common mistake though in application is how we try to calculate the value. What I see sometimes is contracting officers looking only at the labor costs, and if those labor costs fall under those thresholds, trying to say that we're not going to apply this Service Contract Act or the Davis-Bacon Act in that circumstance. But that's not how the Department of Labor would look at it, and that's not how the law was intended to be read. It's meant to look at the total value of the contract, not just pieces of the contract, when determining whether or not we apply those. Nevertheless, again, I've been there. I understand the temptation, but let's avoid that mistake. Those mistakes can be costly. Inevitably, the mistake will be realized, and we'd have to go back and modify the contract at a later point, include wage determinations, make any kind of back wage payments, et cetera, and that can get expensive. So I'd rather look at it the right way up front, as much angst as that may cause. It's just better to do it right the first time. Over.
No, absolutely, Kyle. Yep, you getting it right the first time. Avoid that rework, right? Might be a little inconvenient up front, but it'll save you a lot of time, embarrassment, and resources down the line for sure. So this one we talked about a little bit earlier there with the wage determinations, but another oversight might be overlooking required fringe benefits. Now, we're not just talking the hourly rate here, but fringe benefits are also a major part of compliance. Where do people maybe miss the mark on this one?
I think that's just simply overlooked. Yet you're absolutely spot on. The focus is on the wage portion. That's the biggest piece of a wage determination, the biggest piece of compensation to the employee, and that's cash in pocket. That's what really matters in a lot of people's eyes. But there is that fringe requirement that comes along with it. Every SCA wage determination has a fringe benefit requirement that every employee working under that wage determination is entitled to. On the Davis-Bacon side, not as universal. Some classifications will have a fringe element to them, some will not. But the point is, it's still there. It's part of the total compensation package to the employees. Casting it about another way, you can also look at, for instance, SCA also requires certain amounts of vacation and holidays to employees, while that element may be missing on the Davis-Bacon side. So you have a combination of just overlooking things, as well as there are some fine differences between the Davis-Bacon and SCA world. Nevertheless, they're still part of the required compensation going to the employees. The good news or bad news, again, depending on how you look at it, is in a Davis-Bacon situation, you will see those payments on the weekly payrolls provided by the contractor that don't show us what compensation they provided to their employees across that week. But in an SCA environment, you probably won't see those payrolls at all. If you do, you will see them maybe once a year. So you know, from a compliance perspective on an SCA side, it can be a little bit harder to enforce the fringe requirements. And unfortunately, a lot of the times that comes down to compliance by complaint. In other words, a contracting officer may not know that anything is amiss there until they receive a complaint from an employee. So it's just a little bit of oversight. How do we remedy that? How do we fix that? I won't say it's easy. Nothing is easy. If this job was easy, none of us would be here. But pre-performance conferences, easy place to foot stomp. Hey, contractor, remember, you've got this labor law in your contract. Remember what that brings with it. If you have questions, now's the time to raise those rather than halfway through administration when you realize that, hey, I'm supposed to be paying my people, you know, an additional $5 an hour in fringe benefits. So in a very muddled way, I keep coming back to oversight is the most common cause. Over.
Okay. Yeah. Nope. Another great point there, Kyle. And you kind of hit on it, but the no news is good news is not a good strategy.
Right.
Again, kind of the obtuse style of contract oversight and compliance there. If I don't know about it, it's not happening. Well, a lot of folks can get burnt that way. So,
you bet.
Yeah, absolutely. Dive into it. Realize what's going on. And again, reach out to your team with any questions or concerns. So awesome stuff. So how about this one? Kind of similar. Inserting the wrong clauses, maybe for SCA or Davis-Bacon Act, inserting the wrong clauses in the contract. So a lot of times, as you know, as a former contracting officer, a lot of those clauses might feel like boilerplate type stuff. But as we know, not all are created equal. So what are the consequences of missing or incorporating incorrect clauses?
Got it. Well, fortunately, in this time and era, we have great contracting tools and processes to help us with that, to sort of safeguard against dropping a clause or alternately bringing in a clause that doesn't belong. ConIT, with all of its teething troubles, I think has been pretty good, at least from a labor law perspective. But as would be expected, I mean, accidents will still happen. It's important to remember at the end of the day, as contracting professionals, the document that comes out of ConIT is still our responsibility. We are ultimately in control of that document. So we do bear the heavy burden of ensuring that it's correct and accurate. I'll use an easy example first. Let's look at Davis-Bacon. Here's a bevy of clauses that come with the basic Davis-Bacon clause found at 52.222-6. One of the probably most important ones that is supposed to go hand in hand with that, with application of Davis-Bacon, is the payrolls clause found at 52.222-8. If that clause isn't there, legitimately, the contracting officer has no hard requirement they can point to force an offer, or not necessarily an offer, sorry, a contractor to turn over payrolls on a weekly basis. And what that means is one of those key methods of ensuring compliance, which, going back to one of our earlier mistakes, is the primary responsibility of the contracting agency, not DOL at this point. We lose that tool. So we don't have the ability to see that the contractor is actually in compliance with the Davis-Bacon just through a simple payroll review. So that, you know, that's removed a very valuable and insightful tool from the contracting officer's hands. Switching gears a little bit onto the Service Contract Act front, hand in hand with SCA is supposed to come the everyone's favorite service contract related clause, FAR 52.222-43, the infamous price adjustment clause that requires the contracting officer and the government to make the contractor well for increases in wages or benefits necessary for a changed wage determination. So, right there, right off the bat, again, another tool has been taken out of the contracting officer's hands, and you can bet there will be a little bit of angst on the contractor's part when every time that wage determination changes, there is no outlet for equitable adjustment to the contractor when those wages increase. Again, that could evolve into a dispute. We all know that wages don't go down necessarily; they're only going up, and our contractors generally are not in business for charity, nor is the Air Force or Space Force in the business of running people out of business. So important to make sure we get all the companion clauses in there to make sure that the tools are available to ensure successful contract administration. And in certain cases, Davis-Bacon, looking at you, compliance with the law. Over.
Okay. No more great examples, Kyle. And we've got a couple more oversights to cover, but I think this is a good time as any to just kind of throw in a reminder that, you know, we're putting a lot of onus on the contracting officer, right, with these mistakes and oversights, but our industry partners have an equal stake in this, right? Ensuring the correct labor agreements are in place, ensuring the right wage determination, ensuring the proper clauses are in the contract, right? It's kind of protecting everybody's interests. So, I don't want to, put everything on the CO here. Our industry partners, I believe, also have a big stake in ensuring all of these oversights are not overlooked, correct?
I'd agree wholeheartedly. It is more of a symbiotic relationship. A lot of times we tend to look at contracts as adversarial, but the truth is, once the contract is signed, now both parties are joined together at the hip. We will succeed or fail together. The contractor will presumably succeed and be compensated well for that. If the contractor succeeds, we will get our requirement executed in a timely and prompt fashion. So we do have to recognize that there are two sides in this. So it's a great point. There is always room for questions from industry and questions from potential offerors out there. And I encourage them, if any of those folks are listening to this, don't be shy about asking questions of your contractor. Contracting officer. You may not always like the answer that you get, but ask away. It's better that we catch the mistakes up front rather than, for instance, wait to be caught by the Department of Labor having not applied SCA to a requirement that should have featured SCA, and then having to modify that contract halfway through performance with all the consequences for both parties that that would bring. So that's a very good point that you brought up, sir. Over.
Okay, excellent, Kyle. Thanks for that. And then, communication. And this next oversight you mentioned kind of ties into that. Failing to adequately document labor law decisions. So documentation, as you just mentioned, protects both the mission and the CO. So what kinds of decisions should be captured and how?
Well, drilled into all of us from day one as a contracting professional is document. While there's no outright requirement in the FAR to document whether or not the Service Contract Act or the Davis-Bacon applies or doesn't apply, it's just common sense to leave the paper trail. After all, we never know what's going to happen to us day after tomorrow. Might win the lottery and decide we're not coming back. But somebody's got to pick up that contract file and administer that contract later on. So it's always good to leave the paper trail and let people know what you did and why you did it. In the terms of applying or not applying labor laws, as we may need to, that documentation, that paper trail can serve as a defense to our actions later on. If, for instance, the Department of Labor was to investigate a contract and determine that we may have made the wrong call, that documentation may defend that call. I would also go as far to say documentation of an idea, even if we made the wrong decision, I think gets us partial credit with the Department of Labor. So, but at the end of the day, it's just a good practice to leave a paper trail, document what we did and why we did it. An easy place to document this decision is in whatever kind of acquisition plan is being utilized. If it's a simplified acquisition and we're just using a checklist, a simple memo to the file. And saying, hey, we know that this looks like it's a service, but it's really not, and here's why. And so we're not applying SCA. One paragraph in the file, and that gives the contracting officer or their successor, again, because we never know what's going to happen from day to day, the ammo to go and make the argument with the Department of Labor. No, we properly applied the labor law in this case, and here's why. Here were the factors we considered, and this is why we did what we did. So document. Can't say it enough. Over.
Nope. Absolutely. Another great point there, Kyle. Yeah. Easy enough, right? Hey, this was my decision and this is what I relied on. And this is the rationale behind my decision. So yeah, seems very simple, straightforward. So this last one, we have one more to go. And I think this is probably your bumper sticker for all of your webinars and this particular podcast, not engaging labor advisors early enough. So you saved the big one for last. Again, I think it's your kind of bumper sticker. But tell us why early involvement makes such a difference.
You bet. I'll start off with you might have the best tools in the whole wide world, but if you're not using the tools, you're really not being successful here. So I'm not saying that we're the best and the brightest. Early on, and again, it's easier to remedy a mistake up front than it is changed later on. For instance, finding out that your workforce is going to go out on strike on a Friday afternoon is not a good thing. You probably, as a contracting officer, would have wanted to know that a long time ago so you can adopt any mitigation measures. You can have all the resources in the whole wide world, but they're useless to you if you're not willing to use them. Over.
No, great stuff. Again, thanks again. So it's clear these mistakes or oversights or missteps, all of these probably very well-intentioned, right? They're just kind of overlooked. But They can have significant impacts, as you mentioned, delaying awards, opening the door to legal challenges, adversely affecting mission success. So from your perspective, what are the most effective ways to prevent these issues from occurring in the first place, other than making you my new best friend throughout the whole process?
Right. I really can't come to any one factor apart from just, you know, critical thinking, gaming scenarios out in your head and not being afraid to, again, utilize those resources. Bounce the ideas off your neighbors and your cube mates. Call your regional labor advisor and ask them, hey, this looks a lot like X to me. Do you think it's X or is it really Y? Again, using those resources and taking the extra 30 seconds or the extra 5 minutes to think about it. I know in the rush environment, and say, hey, this is summer right now, and for those in the operational world, this is crunch time. It doesn't get any harder than this. But you know, that extra 30 seconds can save you maybe an extra 30 days of pain a little later on, if we can help correct. And that's not always, sometimes that may mean we get out of applying Service Contract Act, for instance, and save you some pain that way, or alternately bringing it into play when it should have been there. So again, just use those resources, think through things, slow down just a little bit and make sure we're doing things right. It's better to do it right the first time than I have to go back and do the rework. Over.
All right. Absolutely, Kyle. Hey, thanks again for joining us. I think it's been extremely enlightening there. You shared a ton of valuable insight today. But before we close out, before I let you go, if there's one takeaway you want every listener to walk away with, what would it be?
I would say, remember how smart you are. Contracting is a difficult job and requires a lot of brains. Don't sell yourself short. Remember that you've got resources. There's no need to fumble around in the dark looking for answers. Turn the light on. Call your regional labor advisor. Call me. Email me. And we can help get you from A to B. Even if it's not necessarily within our lane, we can at least, you know, try to point you in the right direction. I'd also leave with this remark. I mean, if you have training needs, we can always fulfill those as well. That's one of my favorite things to do, is to try to pass on some of my knowledge that I've acquired and has been passed down to me by my predecessors. You got training needs, whether it's 15 minutes on a phone call or on a conference call, or if it's 2 or 3 days live in a room full of people, we can meet your needs. So don't be shy about reaching out to your regional labor advisor team. And if you have questions about where to find us, everybody knows what SAM.gov is. There's a listing of all the agency labor advisors available in SAM.gov, with the Air Force right up at the top of that list. That's all I've got.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Kyle. Yeah, I think that's a great way to close things out. So as always, a huge thanks to all of our podcast listeners, followers, and subscribers. If you have any feedback, suggestions for topics, or future guests you would like to hear on the podcast, you can submit those via email to thecontractingexperience@gmail.com. As a reminder, you can subscribe to the Contracting Experience podcast from any of your podcast listening platforms. Be sure to subscribe to receive updates and automatic downloads so you don't miss a single episode. I'm your host, Rob Lorton, from the AFMC Contracting Digital Division, and I hope you can join us again on our upcoming episodes. Until then, stay tuned and stay connected.